Welcome to Podcast on Fire Network bonus episode number 6 on Yongari / Reptilian and Galgameth. And so what are we doing here again after the main show where we already covered Yongari and Pulgasari? Well, the movies that we covered, we talked of them as they had remakes. Several decades later, they had their remakes, loose remakes. And you know me, guys. When kaiju is involved and I go big, I wanna do it a lot. So let's utilize the bonus episode section of the website and the format to talk of these late 90s movies that mostly are known as Reptilian and Galgameth. So for our sins, we're offering you this bonus episode with dual reviews of these two movies. And I am Kenny B, and I managed to rope in Paul Quinn of Hangul Celluloid, you know, terrorist kidnapping style, by whacking him in the head and tying him up and blindfolding him. And one trip to a secret location later, and now it's time for the reveal. So, hey, Paul, it's me. We're watching Reptilian. No!
It's all good. It's all good. The bruises don't show. They're sort of below the collar line. It's fine.
This is how I do it on this network. As everyone knows, now you have got the taste for it. Like, when kaiju is concerned, then there's violence involved as well. But it's all good. So welcome back, Paul, and good work on the main show, and thank you for sticking around.
No problem. Glad to be here.
Excellent. So we are jumping right into it. There's no contact information or anything. Just a thanks to anyone who went to the website and started this podcast, because it's website exclusive podcast. This will never be on iTunes or Stitcher or anywhere else except for the website podcastonfire.com. So thank you very much for sticking with us, and there will be another bonus episode during this Korean Kaiju Week coverage about 2 days later after this one is posted. So stick around on podcastonfire.com. This week is it's going to be fun, and you're in the midst of fun. At least I hope so. Anyway, on to the first review, and it's Yongari, a.k.a. Reptilian, from 1999/2001. And why it's /2001, I'll explain later on. Plot, first of all, from IMDb. A team of scientists working on a remote dig site find the buried body of an enormous monster, perfectly preserved even after 200 million years. As soon as the beast is uncovered, however, an alien spacecraft suddenly appears above them and brings the monster back to life. The creature immediately sets about leveling the surrounding urban landscape and shrugging off the best firepower the military can throw at it. A lone scientist working on decrypting an ancient set of hieroglyphics may be on the verge of finding the alien's weak point, but will it be too late? Sounds pretty good. Yeah, exciting. but that's all I say right now. It was released in the US as Reptilian, and it's from the director of the, pretty much, if you go by the word of mouth out there, even I picked up on this fact, it's from the director of the 100% globally despised D-War from 2007, and it's from the director Shim Hyung-rae. And Yongari was just like D-War, shot with the international market in mind, as it featured, and in the entire cast was Westerners. It's an English language film. It was criticized at the time of release, talking Yongari again, for its bad acting and even unpolished computer-generated imagery, which led to fears that they weren't even finished, the special effects footage. But it has, after all is said and done, actually found a cult following over the years. It could have been inspired by, it could have had a desire to be better than the Roland Emmerich directed Godzilla US remake. That's just a theory. And after all is said and done as well, when talking the old Yongari and this Yongari, you know, it's just another monster film with, and the monster is called that. You know, it's not a straight remake of the Kim Ki-duk 1967 film, which is very evident in the design as well as, the alien plot. And speaking of the design, you know, he has a diamond placed on his forehead, which was not in the original. So, you know, Shim probably a fan of Yon Garry and wanted to update it, but really it's just the monster. It's a monster movie and the name, and that's pretty much it. But so loose remake, still per definition remake, if you want to really be picky about it. So back to D-War. I mean, we could have done D-War as a bonus episode, but why stir up trouble with everyone again? At I guess speaking to you, Paul, as more of an expert and a frequent Korean cinema watcher than I am, I mean, number one, have you seen D-War? And number two, even if you haven't, what's with the hate for it? I mean, I've never heard anyone say, hey, it's good fun.
I'll be honest with you, I haven't seen it, and the reason I haven't seen it is because everybody has heard exactly what you heard. A lot of Korean cinema, people will slag it off, and you'll get one decent review, and you think, okay, I'll give it a look, and you're surprised, you love it, sometimes. With this, there's nothing good said about it anywhere. I just think, but from what I can figure, just looking at his filmography, he's gone straight from this Reptilian and thought, okay, it was a bit rubbish, but let's try and do another big, you know, wow, let's do D-War, which I think from Dragon War, isn't it?
I think so. It seems like there's dragons in that movie rather than big monsters.
It seems to me that he's tried to jump on it and do something that actually works. It's flopped hideously, and when you look at his next film, The Last Godfather, you just think, okay, you've completely given up on that, and you've headed towards gangster now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I haven't heard that much bad stuff about it, so maybe he's found what he's looking for, and this is all guesswork, but, you know, you go from one Korean director to the next, they know what they like, and they may jump out every now and again, but they'll more than likely jump back in to, you know, whether they do dramas, whether they do thrillers, whether they do romantic comedies, this just seems to be a jump from one extreme to another, trying to fix it and then jumping away again. I think he's been looking for something that people are going to say is okay.
And I mean, I don't know what the publicity support was like for D-War, but clearly a bigger budgeted film than Reptilian. They got the name cast in there. What was it, Robert Forster? That starred or co-starred in it. So a desire was there, and clearly a like of the genre. I mean, But the only monster movie that kind of has worked in Korea and has a good international reputation that I can think of, even though I wasn't 5 out of 5 wild about it, was The Host.
Yeah, well, exactly. And, you know, it comes down to the bit that's just made by one of the greatest directors there is. You know, on a complete sideline, I interviewed the director of The Thieves a few days ago, and one thing he said to me stuck, and it sort of made me think of The Host, because The Thieves is just overtaken at the box office. And he said, you know, what does a good film need? It needs three things: good character, good character, good character. And if you look at The Host, you love those characters, you feel for them, you live with them. You look at Reptilian, you kind of don't. You laugh at them a little bit. And I imagine D-War, you actually just want them to have something bad happen to them, to be honest with you.
Yeah, you wonder if D-War, I mean, I'm sure I will give it a go because I'm such a sadist, that you wonder if it was...
You really must be.
Have you heard what I watched on all the other shows on the network? I mean, I have no problem with this.
Ken, it gives me a giggle every morning when I get up and check your feed. I just think, oh, look what he's been watching last night. Wow. So, you know, it's all good. You can let me know what it's like. And if you dare lie and say it's great and I watch it and it isn't, there'll be bruises the other way, okay?
Yeah, you wonder if it's just devoid of cheesy fun, or I mean, if it's just... that's my fascination with it. If it's just a complete bore with no energy in the special effects, you know what I mean? So it kind of fascinates me, this 100% hate for it, because you can find sometimes a 70-30 divide between audiences, exactly. But here it's, you know, no one likes it.
Exactly, and even if you look at Reptilian as, I don't know if you're going to agree with me or not, but I find it easier to sit through than a lot of American language movies because of the cheese factor, and I just think he's tried to make a big movie that's really down the line and really serious, and it's just been so serious, it's been awful.
Yeah, it's that's an art in making, you know, a genre movie that is mostly connected to fun and having an entertainment. If you dare to like go grave and serious on us, then that takes a massive amount of skill. And I guess that connected back to the host, which if my memory is correct, I mean, had its light moments, but still was very grave and serious because it was a family drama as well.
Totally, but it's that whole Bong Joon-ho thing of lulling you into a false sense of security with lightness and then hitting you, and it drags you down further, you know, and then just giving you a little bit of respite, so you're up, your emotions are up and down. It's all emotional, you know, and I just can't see it for D-War. Enjoy watching it. Let me know what you think.
Thank you. Anyway, back to Yongari or Reptilia. What sounds like a silly little genre film was actually supported by, you know, a notable publicity and advertising campaign. You know, and a huge, a huge budget in terms of that, because the Korean film market wanted to get more of a rep overseas, and this was their chosen project. I mean, it's not a bad pick. I mean, it's a genre and a type of movie that could play globally, and even though they might have, they could have made it, you know, with a Korean cast and all of that, but you still have, it's not a purely Korean genre, this, so it's global, it's a good choice. And, you know, at the time, giant posters were hung outside Korean theaters, and a parade was staged with a life-size replica of Yongari, and the toy company Songo Kong released Yongari figures, including a what's called a SD wind and walk figure, and a 12-inch vinyl figure. But this worked. I mean, the movie was pre-sold extensively and earned back a third of its budget via pre-sales. So good job in that regard. But the movie was panned by critics when it came out and sold 3 million tickets in Korea, which I imagine is not necessarily good.
It's not good. It's not terrible. Mm-hmm. You know, there are a lot of films that don't do that well and sell, you know, a million tickets, and they're considered, well, you know, we'll wait for the next thing. So 3 million's not that bad. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not the 13 million of The Thieves or anything close to The Host, but yeah, it's not a complete flop. Internationally, different story, you know.
Again, a 1999 movie, but here we go back to why there was two production dates connected to Yongari or Reptilia. It was re-released in 2001 with improved special effects and added footage. But this re-release didn't have the promo juggernaut and did apparently very poorly. It was actually screened under a different title. The premiere of it was in Japan at the Japanese Film Festival, and that different title in English was apparently Armageddon Beast Yongari. Sounds fantastic, though.
It really does, yeah.
Among the scenes that were added to this 2001 upgrade was the beginning of the film with a team of archaeologists entering the cave, and an extra character called Mr. Mills was added. And if my memory is correct, and I don't remember a lot of characters because they're not worth remembering, but Mr. Mills, I think, was one of the military folks at the mission control. But in reality, I don't know, and I don't care. The original Korean score by Song Woo Cho was replaced by a new ambient score by Chris Desmond. And overall, the original version of the film was tampered with by, they redid it about 60%, and therefore it's you know, it came out after the millennium, so it's also kind of referred to in some places as the Youngari millennium. Didn't really help though, that redux, if you will. That's the version most of you have seen and probably are ever going to see, because that this first version reportedly only received a subtitled Korean VHS. Again, this movie is in English, but there was never a DVD in Korea. And as Reptilian, and in the form of the 2001 version, as I said, it is available on DVD in several countries, including Japan, France, and the US. And as far as I know, the original 1999 edition is, you know, still fairly rare. It's not been, it hasn't popped up. But maybe collector's items in some circles, and maybe going for huge amounts of money. But I am kind of curious about how it looked, because the upgrade is not perfect, as we'll discuss in the review right now. So, as we always do, Paul, a little bite-sized like or dislike for Youngari or Reptilia. So, what does that say?
I'm going to completely ruin every hope of a career of talking about anything by saying I didn't hate it. I really didn't. I hate American remakes of Korean films. I detest them. I've spent the last month slagging them off in talks left, right, and center.
Wasn't it you that finally sat down and took in My Sassy Girl, the US remake?
Five attempts I had to get through that. Five attempts. Seriously.
For like a 90-minute movie.
For a 90-minute movie. The worst remake I have ever seen. And I've seen, you know, I've seen Mirrors, which is awful. I've seen The Lake House, which is even worse. My Sassy Girl. Oh dear. You know, I bought the DVD secondhand for £1.
Good man.
Just so I could watch it. And as soon as I'd watched it, I took it out and I put it in the bin. Because it's just... So I don't like remakes of Korean films. Essentially, I'm one of the people that thinks, watch the Korean film. Mm-hmm. Okay, so it's a remake and they've switched it and it's, you know, it's made by a Korean, etc., etc. But I didn't hate it specifically because of the humor. And it's accidental humor, fair enough. Hmm. And the original was accidental humor, but there are noticeable, as with, hopefully, if you can ever shut me up, later on we can talk about what I saw in it that relates to what Korea was doing at the time and what they're still sort of doing. And it sort of, it nods its head to so many films. Mm-hmm. And for me, that almost gave me pleasure, being able to say, look, you've just stolen that and you've just stolen that.
I'm all for stealing, but if you do it with heart, that's even better. There's a Taiwanese filmmaker called Chu Yanping who directed Island of Fire, which, you know, steals scenes from, among other things, Cool Hand Luke. But it's fantastic theft, in my opinion. So I'm all for that. But before we go on, I actually agree with you. I didn't hate it either. It is a big piece of Youngari doo-doo. But,
yeah, so totally.
But it has its moments, even though those moments are, to be really fair, merely minutes in length in total, but it's a 90-minute movie. I wasn't bored and I didn't hate it. So we're linked. We're synced up.
We're on the same track there. You know?
I think we are.
It's watchable, and it's almost funny watchable, which I don't have a problem with.
Absolutely. So starting a little from the beginning and my initial notes here. To be really honest, this movie has a TV feeling. It doesn't have a big cinematic really feeling. I mean, that doesn't have to do with being shot in 185 rather than the big 2.35 format. It's a flat, very flat looking movie, and it seems like something that would play on the sci-fi channel, if you will, and rather than being a big cinematic spectacle. It's pretty bad. In that department, it doesn't jump at you. And what is very evident from the start is you're not getting any confidence in the acting department here. I mean, so some of the actors look downright scared to be there.
Yeah, watching them, frightening in itself.
I mean, that added scene at the beginning where they're into the cable and stuff like that. So some of the assistants to a wonderful character of Campbell, they look downright scared to deliver their dialogue. I mean, oh boy.
And some of them actually hesitate as they're doing it.
Yes, exactly.
Especially one, I don't know what his name was, but one sort of slightly overweight guy, and he's meant to be looking scared, but you just think you can't remember your line, can you? It's just, it's wonderful. I mean, that first scene, the first thing that hit my head, and it's completely just from my childhood watching rubbish TV on a Saturday afternoon, but when they walk into that cave and you see all the stonework, I just thought that's the original Star Trek. Like, it's exactly the same sets. It's made with the same stuff. It looks like the foam that it is. Cool, you know. So
while I'm talking about all the bad things here and that I'm being judgmental against the movie before even you know, properly starting, I mean, I can't, even if I tried and with a gun to my head, find any true, you know, no notions of hate here, because you know, I know it's bad, but I know. And after the movie was finished, definitely knew that it had a fairly snapping pace, and it has its moment, as we will discuss. So, you know, I'm also thinking that there is a problem here in terms of before I say anything, as far as we know, the director Shim is not American, Korean, or anything like that. So directing English actors, I mean, you do need to bring forth skill to direct actors, but that doesn't seem to happen here. It seems like they're left to their own devices, almost, to hit the dialogue in what they think is maybe the proper way. I mean, there's not much guidance here in terms of getting, bearable to, so to say, prop acting through.
Totally. And that sometimes goes through to actual Korean cinema as well, because you'll get the odd American actor in a really decent Korean film who shouldn't be acting at all, or certainly shouldn't be acting in that film. And I think it's down to the same thing. I think it's really hard to direct actors in a language that isn't theirs. Comes to mind, I can't even remember the guy's name, but the pilot in Welcome to Domical.
Tesler or Kessler or something like that.
See, your memory's a lot better than mine. I love the movie. I detested him. Everything was really telegraphed the whole way through. You take even the American at the start of The Host. It's not as bad, but it's not perfect. You know, once we get rid of him, the actual host for me starts. So I think this is a common thing, so, you know.
But then again, it could be down to a lack of skill of directing actors in general. I mean, I haven't seen any other of Shim's films that are in Korean, but who knows if there is a general feeling of this guy is not very focused on delivering performances.
And that's a very fair point as well.
some highlights from the actors. I mean, they do attempt to describe the monster here, and when I say attempt, it's because the actors are often left to act against nothing in this movie, which is common for special effects. Obviously, you look at nothing, and the special effects are put in afterwards, but they are clearly so separate from any minor physical thing to spur their imagination. You know, they're so separate from the special effects, and it's so badly delivered the way they describe, you know, the monsters. You know, he's so big and ugly. I mean, they say that twice. You know, why is he ugly? Later in the film, where the military is attacking him on jetpacks, you know, Godzilla is a pussy. Meet my little friend. I mean, no, but okay, I kind of enjoyed that, but it's kind of groan-inducing as well, when that is probably plays into the fact that, you know, Shim, I like Godzilla, let's call him a pussy, I like Scarface, let's incorporate that, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Fair point, being a movie fan is great, but, you know, you kind of shake your head and smile at the same time, which is, I guess, a fairly good reaction in a weird way. You know, you're not saying like, no! You're saying, oh boy, okay.
Well, yeah, exactly. And I mean, he does at times try to actually inject humor into those sort of little things as well. I mean, there's one guy sort of later on in the film who looks at up at nothing, obviously, and yeah. says, if he was any scarier, he'd be my wife. And you just think, it's almost good. It's not, it's awful, but it's almost good, you know. So you got to give a point somewhere along the line.
I think so. I mean, one of the actual few scenes they're acted in a very natural way. I wanted to single this out because we trashed, you know, the direction of acting up until this point. But there is a meeting at the mission control between the people at mission control and one of the representatives from this covert agency, and they sit down to have an exposition, essentially, and he tells the audience that they know about these aliens that are coming. And that scene is one of the few scenes that features fairly well-delivered dialogue, natural sounding dialogue, despite being ludicrous because the plot is all sci-fi and big.
Totally. But, you know, I mean, that sort of says reptilian through and through. One little segment, whatever you're dealing with, whether it be effects or acting or little storyline bit, you'll think, actually, you could almost get away with that, and 2 seconds later you're just thinking, oh, stop. You know, it's grabbed where it can, I guess, or it works where it can, and they're few and far between. But yeah, that scene is actually not bad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it made me sit up because, hey, I'm sensing something is better right now. Something is unusual for this movie. But again, this story is compared to the original updated with scope, and therefore scope in this case means let's involve space, let's involve aliens. And here's, you know, some real mistakes. Not that story, but Shin doesn't really build up his story well at all. And for instance, in terms of the aliens, all of a sudden, boom, cut to, we see the aliens in the ships looking like finger puppets, and they speak English. And you know, come on, man, build up some menace. No, cut directly to finger puppet aliens speaking English. Come on, man. And I mean, fine, funny to speak about, but that just shows a real lack of focus and skill in providing interest.
It really does.
Yeah. And I don't know, I got hung up on the fact that, really, are you not even attempting to have some cool alien space language, you know, with subtitles, you know? No. They speak literally English, but what are you going to do? Let's walk straight over to one of the only compelling characters in this movie, and it's the brief bad guy of this movie, and it's the character of Campbell who leads this dig, where they are starting to dig up the bones and what have you. Talk about, I'm sure you have some notes on this, over actor that isn't very intimidating, but it makes the movie while he's in it.
Yeah, yeah, totally. Overacts from his first syllable to his last.
I think his name is Richard Livingston, by the way, according to IMDb.
I wonder if he ever worked again. He does make the movie, but it's the same thing. It's down to the, oh my dear Lord. There's one scene where he sits down with his assistant. I think her name's Holly. And Holly, apart from anything else, Holly is English, thereby showing that she's intelligent, you know, top-notch assistant, very, you know, the whole, oh, we'll make her English, that'll be great. He sits down at a table, she's about to squeal on him, and he says no, and slams his cup down, and the entire contents of the copy just fly out all over the place. And he just carries on, and you just think, they left that in. They must have left it in for humor, and then you think, no,
I'll make it art.
You know, just slaps it down, everything goes everywhere, and he just carries on in his over-emphasized way. It's great.
You go until director say cut.
Well, yeah, exactly. It sounds like Jim Young Ray didn't ever say cut. You know,
it's but, acting.
So he is very memorable as this leader, and you know, when Yongari is awakened by the aliens, you know, the actors hardly sell the panic, but what Richard does here in terms of he sells a moment, and it's the moment that pretty much everyone quotes when looking at this movie. When Yongari is awakened and starting to destroy everything and kill everything, you know, he for some reason has gotten in his head that he's the master of Yongari, because he shouts at Yongari, but in reality against nothing. He just has a tight camera on him and a lot of wind machines on him, and starts shouting, you know, to Yongari, "I'm your creator, I made you." What happens like a few moments after that? Splat.
Huge foot right on him.
And that's him out of the movie. It's like, oh, what a shame. Okay. He brought the energy. Of course, it's a terrible performance. But he did bring energy, and I think energy is such a key sometimes. I mean, we are forgiving viewers, at least in the case of this movie. So in reality, I think maybe not a whole lot of people like this performance and would say that it's completely devoid of energy, and it's, you know, it shouldn't be put next to, it shouldn't be called acting at all. And I mean, it's true, but you know what? I think it made the movie for a few minutes, you know.
I tend to agree with you. You know, it's in the same level again. It's that you, whether you laugh with it or laugh at it, gently,
yes,
it's his performance that.
I mean, it's so out of left field. It's not like we've given like a build up towards the fact that he has some kind of god complex, and all of a sudden, I made you. I'm your creator. What, really?
And I mean, you could. You can read so many things into anything you want, and I tend to do it all the time, far too much.
It's about family.
No, let's not do the family thing. Later. If I got that big a reputation on Family God...
At least, in one show, our main show.
Oh, dear, that's scary. Constant movies came to mind when I was watching this, and I mean that, I'm your creator, I made you. I just thought, well, that's almost what Frankenstein says to the monster,
mm-hmm,
whenever, you know, he's alive, he's alive.
Yeah.
When this was made, Korea was doing its utmost to start competing with Hollywood. And I can't get away from the thought that this has been directed and ideas from specific Hollywood movies have been thrown in to try and make it fit like a Hollywood movie.
Mm-hmm.
They've been doing it ever since. They still do it now. But it just, there were constant things. As they were going up a set of steps towards, I can't even remember what it was, I thought, that's from King Kong. I saw Frankenstein in this, you know. There's one part where, I don't know if it's Campbell or another character, to be honest, but he almost says, no, I'll go and talk to young Gary. And that's straight out of, you know, the whole, he said, trying to remember the film about green aliens and the Earth. Mm-hmm. I might have to go and look at my DVD collection. Straight out of one really famous 1950s movie. It's almost like they've gone, we'll take that little bit and we'll just whack it in the middle, and then that's what famous movies do. These are big lines. It just constantly screamed at me.
Mm-hmm.
And the movie I was trying to think of, believe that I didn't almost forget War of the Worlds. God.
Oh, yeah.
That whole thing, War of the Worlds, that priest goes, I'm going to go and talk to the alien. The alien kills him. You know, Campbell says, I'm going to go and talk to young Gary. He doesn't go, but he's killed 2 minutes later anyway.
Mm-hmm.
It constantly said to me that they're really saying, grab bits of Hollywood movies, stick them in, grab, because this, we're making a Hollywood movie here.
Yeah, to be really honest, thinking about all that, because I subconsciously, I think I got that, but couldn't really pin, what kind of moment are they echoing here? But my point is, having said all this, it's not that poorly integrated, because we're not talking scenes lifted beat by beat into the movie from somewhere else. You know, we're not talking about techniques that Taiwanese director Chu Yanping utilized for certain movies. So in that regard, I think it's not too bad in terms of the referencing and inserting it into the structure.
No, I totally agree. Yeah, it almost gives a tiny little nod. If I'm not completely reaching from nowhere and seeing things that aren't there, I don't think I am. I think those things are there. I think he said we'll get a few little sound bites because they're quite cool, and they're all sound bites that I remember from my favorite American movies from when I was growing up. So that I'm convinced there's something there. But yeah, it's not scene for scene. It's not big segments. It's more just little statements.
All right, let's move on to the special effects, or the lack of them. Here's the thing. I should preface this by saying that I think Shim has a knack here in certain scenes of providing a combination of physical destruction and CG elements. There's some good pyrotechnic work here. Explosions and a mix of CG within that. So that's fine. And I think the energy is pretty good at times. But here's the problem. Most of the time, and again, we're talking about the upgraded cut. I mean, my God, what did this look like in 1999? But most of the time here in the 2001 cut, there's no shading or shadowing on Yong Gary. He looks flat and too bright. And yeah, literally, the effects look unfinished. It's not like this movie has grown old over a decade or so, and this was top notch in 2001, and since technology moved so fast and developed so fast that our eyes now see this as, you know, completely rubbish. They literally look unfinished. You know, someone just forgot to shade or color correct and put shadowing on the monsters, because Yong Gary is a complete CG creature aside from essentially some physical stuff at the site where they discover it, but then it's not awakened. I mean, there is just big bones. So it's obviously a lack of budget that to provide, you know, super sharp special effects. I get that, but I don't know. I wasn't firmly taken out of the movie because I realized that this is what I'm dealing with. Okay, let's accept that and see if there's some snappy energy within the various fights between Yong Gary and the military. And to be honest, Paul, I think there is.
Yeah, so do I.
Despite looking the transparency, literal transparency in the special effects.
It's funny, I mean, for me, it was the same thing again. Some of, like you say, some of the special effects actually work quite well, but it's that same thing of you've got something that you think, okay, cool. And 3 seconds later, whether it's Yong Gary not being finished in his CGI or it's buildings that actually look exactly like what they are, tiny little models. Mm-hmm. And then it goes back to something that looks like it's finished and looks like it's well done, and it just jumps back and forward, and you just think, was it budget? Did you just not have time to finish half your effects?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so
yeah, you wonder if there was a time constraint in terms of you know, they granted him to go back, but not a whole lot, including time. Perhaps, I mean, we're theorizing here. I didn't read anything when doing my research about extensive articles about the process going into the 2001 cut, but you know, the proof is in the cinema here. But the ideas are pretty nifty. I mean, I like the fact that the military destroys more than Yong Gary, essentially.
Yeah.
Missiles just crumble that entire city, and there's people in there. I mean, I think there's a huge death toll in this movie, although it's not shown, but I think there's a huge death toll.
I think there's bound to be.
And there's a wonderful idea about the fact that Yong Gary, although he's controlled by the aliens, he actually ducks when missile moves away from missiles, literally just takes a step back and the missile explodes in front of him.
Or
just ducks, bends his head.
Fabulous.
And that was a pretty good idea, and despite being unfinished slash sort of finished, that was conveyed, because we're talking about it with, you know, with a smile on our faces and kind of laugh about it. That was an idea that was at least conveyed to a point. And that I appreciated. It goes on a bit too long, because Shim is clearly in love with the destruction. So it seems like they go on repeat. You know, he ducks, moves away, ducks, moves away from the missiles about 3 or 4 times. But then they bring in the jetpack. So what did you think of the strategy about fighting Yongari on jetpacks?
Well, what else are you going to do? Do you know what I mean? They've tried everything else. They tried missiles, they tried bullets. Actually, they tried the bullets after the missiles, but that, by the way. So, come on, jetpacks, you've got to do it.
And that's kind of a brilliant thing as well. I mean, here's, even in a finished movie, I think the blue screen and green screen stuff would have been pretty noticeable. That happens with big movies as well. But, you know, it's one of many elements in cinema that I'm weak for, and I think jetpacks are kind of awesome.
Yes, yeah,
it's this. It's Goldfinger. Was it Goldfinger? Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, I think it was.
And Angel 3, the Hong Kong movie, where Alex Fong and company fly in on jetpacks that are equipped with machine guns as well. So it's brilliant. But that they did kind of for real, as good as they could anyway. So there is a spectacle here that I appreciated, and it's a 90-minute movie. It moves at this point, because it's almost all action, with, again, the actors mostly standing in mission control, reacting to nothing, standing at the side of the street, looking up, reacting to nothing. You know, the mix, at least in the second half here, the last, let's say, 30 minutes, despite the unfinished special effects, if we're going to label them that, it's not bad. I thought it was sort of a spectacle, finally. They wanted a big cinematic spectacle. Finally, it is for at least a reel.
Again, I tend to agree. You know, I didn't even think about pausing there to go and get a new cup of coffee. I just thought, you know, you just watch it, and that means it works on some level.
So there clearly is something in our director here that's not been put, you know, to better use, and maybe maybe no one will ever give him money to attempt this again. But for some reason in my notes I wrote like something to compare to, you know, because it does feel like a TV movie. You know, honestly, I mean, you can't get away from that. You know, I see current TV movies because I watch so much crap. I saw, like, what was it? It might be a few years old by now, but I saw, like, Anaconda 3, the David Hasselhoff movie.
Yeah.
I mean, the Anaconda effect is really crap in that one. It's finished, but it's really crap, and it gives off the same vibe, kind of, that it's, you know, if you accept it on that level, I guess that's my point, too, if you're going into Reptilian, it's, you gotta retune yourself. Think that this is kind of a direct-to-DVD thing, or something that you found while flipping channels and you ended up on sci-fi.
And I mean, going into it, I kind of knew what to expect, so I was already in that frame set, and I guess that's why it hit me as well as it did. Mm-hmm. Whether that would happen if you just watched it from scratch, I think you pretty quickly know what the deal was.
Yeah.
I don't know, but you know, going into it, as long as you've got your mind in the set that this is probably going to give you a bit of a giggle, then it's worth watching.
Mm-hmm.
On that level alone.
Very good. I think that sums up our feelings. It's both Yongaris are worth watching them, because they are different eras, different in vibe. And so go watch both. It's not redundant to watch both, you know, to have a double bill between Yongari and Yongari.
There is one little issue I have, though, that I want to do before we, you know, put it to bed.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the overall storyline, you've got aliens that can fire huge laser blasts,
mm-hmm,
down, destroy whatever, but they choose to control a monster to go and stamp on buildings for 90 minutes. And then, you know, make him disappear up into the spacecraft or whatever, and then send him back down again. And the only thing they say to justify it is at the end, where they say, no one's discovered his real power. And you just think, why didn't you just blow everybody up?
I never noticed these things during my viewings. You're totally right, but I'm such a dumb viewer that I can never, like, go into logical territory.
Well, I don't know if it's logical, but it just occurred to me. Why don't you just... Maybe it's laziness. If I was going to take over the world or blow it up, I'd kind of want to blow it up. I wouldn't send a monster down to...
And they have a big Armada, seemingly, too, with ships around a big penis ship. I mean, it's a... looked a bit phallic to me, but whatever. That's where my mind is at too. Like, there are the testicles and there's the phallic symbol. Yeah.
I don't necessarily think you're wrong there either. You know, same sort of thing came to my mind. You just like, that's a dodgy looking spaceship.
It's a dude. Anyway. I mean, it's a dude that made this movie, so you know, so someone got a giggle out of that, you know.
So.
So unless you have any other notes, Paul, we can go into...
I think we've pretty much covered it up.
Yeah, for our sins, we've actually kind of recommended Reptilian. So go out and get it. It's pretty... It should be easy to find used, since it did get fairly wide DVD release all over the world. So after the brief musical break, we are going to talk of the sort of loose remake of Pulgasari that the original director, now known as Simon Sheen in America, presented and provided the story for. So it's Galgameth after a break, or The Adventures of Galgameth from 1997. So stick with us and we'll be right back. So, welcome back, and this is the second half of the first bonus episode, and we are covering Galgameth, or The Adventures of Galgameth. The on-screen title is Galgameth. I'm getting tired of saying that name already, but whatever. The plot of this 1997 movie goes as follows. Very short. A young prince fights to free his people with the help of his family mascot, a small dragon who grows upon eating metal, and is called Galgameth, or called Galgi. Okay, I'm letting my thoughts out already. But anyway, and Galgameth is directed by and co-starring Sean McNamara. He plays King Henrik in the film. I think that's the father of the kid. He's also director of Soul Surfer, a fairly recent movie, the true life story about surfer Bethany Hamilton, who lost her arm to a shark attack, and it details her journey back. And it was known for its quite pronounced Christian themes. And I'm not saying that because I'm judging it. I've not seen the movie, so I can't praise, pan, or judge it. But I believe Rufus mentioned on the main show that he didn't like the Soul Surfer, personally. McNamara has, anyway, otherwise produced shows for MTV, Nickelodeon, The Disney Channel, and Cartoon Network. And funnily enough, as this is a loose remake of Pulgasari, it was not McNamara's baby fully. The original co-director of Pulgasari, Shin Sang-ok, was the presenter, and he has story credit on the film. So I don't know, maybe not painful to bring back the memories of directing under Kim Jong-il, so to say, but here you go, Ed. That's the connection. That's why we're doing it in a bonus episode. Shin Sang-ok is on the film as Simon Sheen, as his credit was when he got to America. And the Disney Channel has screened Galgameth frequently, and it had at least a DVD release in Australia, but it's also streaming for free on Hulu for our American listeners, so you can catch it there. So that's it, and okay, Paul, let it out. What did you think in short first of Galgameth?
And you want it short? Oh, I might be here for a while.
well, try and keep it short first, and then we'll rant after that.
I have a bit of a problem in general with remakes of Korean films, and we talked about Yeongeri and the remake of it, and it sort of, in a accidentally funny way, actually worked for me. This doesn't. It's awful.
Yep.
It's terrible. There are no words that are strong enough to say how much I hated this film.
A big pile of galgy doo doo.
Yeah, and you know, there's issue one, Galje. Oh.
Yeah. Well, that's a good tease, Paul. So let's just stop it right there, and we'll go on after that. My view, although it's not poorly produced as such, and there's so much special effects and suit acting, whether showing Galgameth big, small, you know, that's fine. And the combo of this being an American children's movie, combined with familiar kaiju tactics, kind of tickles. But not for very long at all. It's still an overlong bore that feels as just like a Reptilian. Feels also very TV in execution, and this was boring. And we are talking maximum 5 minutes of stuff that tickled me. Otherwise, not recommended at all. So, you know, apparently Shin Sang-ok, as I said, wasn't scarred. That's why he definitely picked himself to go back to Pulgasari. Not really a movie that screams, you know, let's transfer it to, an American children's aura, if you will. But that is interesting. Just put yourself into the headspace of Shin or Simon Shin. That, you know, I got a bone to pick for Pulgasari. I want to remake it on my own terms or something like that. But that didn't result in anything good, though. So, you know, that's just a theory. But what do you want to lead with? What is wrong with this movie, mainly?
There are so many things. I mean, from my point of view of what I do in terms of Korean film, everything that made Pulgasari for me what it was, and anybody that's listened to the previous episode will have heard me ranting on and on about family, blah, 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 as I do a lot. Everything's been stripped out. There's nothing here. Everything that gave it a real story, that gave it any sort of attempt at social commentary, gone. They mentioned family twice. It just screams, not even Disney, just Saturday afternoon children's TV, you know, Robin of Sherwood, this whole medieval thing. There's no, yeah, okay, there's a tyrant, fair enough, but there's no reason for them sacrificing this, that, and the other, which is the whole deal of Pulgasari. He's not created with blood, which was sort of the blood of the people making this monster to free themselves. It's all gone.
I don't even remember how he was created here, to be honest.
It sort of seemed, as far as I could see, you know, it was, oh, he's sleeping, oh, look, magic, and then it turns into sort of a water thing later on. You think, really, was it? Okay. And the other thing, 3 or 4 times through the movie, they keep mentioning that they're in Donegal. Donegal's in Northern Ireland. I'm Northern Irish.
Uh-oh.
Nobody in Donegal speaks with an American accent or a very, very strong English accent, and putting little Irish jigs in the bar scenes doesn't cut any ice. I'm sorry to be
naive here, Paul, but isn't that the most random thing ever, or is it actually a sort of famous place to, and they set movies there every now and again?
Well, they set movies there every now and again, but the whole thing about Donegal is the Irish mythology. You know, the same way Korean stuff has Korean mythology. They didn't do the whole medieval suits, armor, jousting thing. That's not Donegal. So it's completely random why they picked it. I have no idea, but it annoyed on a massive level. But that's just because I'm Northern Irish.
I want to go back slightly, you know, to a basic aspect here. I personally, although I like longer movies, okay, but I do feel a bit allergic to running times most of the time. I judge sometimes when a movie is, in my mind, way too long. And this being 100 minutes, that's triggered my movie allergies. You know what I mean? And on Wikipedia, it says it was 1 hour and 50 minutes. It's like, no, I'm going to be here forever. But you know what? Classic movies that are 3-4 hours long, I have no problems with. So it obviously depends on the movies and all of that. But I wanted to ask you, after so many years of liking Korean cinema, is this ever an issue for you? Like, it's 130 minutes, this rom-com from Korea, or do you just it just breezes by, crap or not.
It depends what it is. I mean, Korean cinema, as you know, recently has been, you know, heading way past the 2-hour mark. Mm-hmm. You know, something like Moss, I think it's 165 minutes. It takes you 3 seconds to go through.
And as long as this, as well.
You know, yeah, totally. Massively long, way over long as well. But that doesn't necessarily annoy me. There'll be bits that I think, well, you need to cut a load out of that, or you don't need that, or you don't need that.
What do you think it is, really? I mean, because clearly there's an issue here of some movies being padded. I mean, in all honesty, sometimes in director's cuts, like My Sassy Girl, which is, I didn't like the movie, but, and I saw it in the long version, and it just seemed like it went on and on and on. It's just indulgent. But regular cuts, do you feel that indulgence is there, or what's going on?
I actually spoke to a director a while back who told me that they'd been forced almost, when they'd made a movie that was 100 minutes, to stretch it to 120. They've got this thing of, oh, if we're going to compete with Hollywood, we've got to give value for money when people are sitting watching it, and they do have a tendency to stretch stuff out. Huh. And there is the other thing that, you know, Korean cinema, a lot of it starts slow and builds and builds, and they'll almost stretch it out to the point where you're dying for a huge amount of action or knifing or whatever to happen. So it's a common thing, and it doesn't annoy me when the content's good enough.
Sure.
But with something like this, which is, you know, an hour and a half or whatever, an hour and 15 minutes, but like you say, by 10 minutes in, I was thinking, this is too long.
Just as a minor example, I was delighted and surprised by, I know every Korean movie isn't that long, but you know, I go into that mindset, and when I saw Going by the Book recently, which is a movie that's set in essentially like 3 or 4 locations, 100 minutes, though. Oh, how delightful. I like you already, movie.
Yeah, it's a fair deal when they pack along, and the one downside of Korean stuff is you do feel sometimes that it has deliberately been stretched. Mm-hmm. I mean, I keep talking about Yoongo, which is a new film. It's the one about the 70-year-old and the 15-year-old schoolgirl, you know, a controversial relationship, whatever. Mm-hmm. For an hour and a half, that is the most beautiful film in the world. And for about 25 minutes, they stick in this mystery thriller bit to try and, oh, let's get something happening. And to my mind, that's the whole thing of them stretching it out to 2 hours to make it this length. And it doesn't need it. You know, you take that out, you've got this gorgeous film that just touches your heartstrings. You dump that in, and they're just going, and pulling it out to that length that they want to have.
I actually noticed that with watching so many old school martial arts movies that often ended up at 90, 95 minutes, and you know, it definitely wasn't needed. They filled it often with comedies, with comedy from mid-70s and onwards. And it's a beautiful thing when someone sat down and for their market, and mainly I'm talking about German market, that was a big market for martial arts movies. They sat down, edited movies down between like 10, 15 minutes sometimes, and just streamlined it perfectly.
Yeah.
And they clearly took out stuff that was padding, even walking shots and driving shots and what have you. So I could definitely say that I think there's a conscious decision and the demand that you gotta get it up there. And thankfully, there were exceptions in Korean cinema. There are exceptions, again, Going by the Book. Clearly didn't have that demand on it to go up to 130 minutes. I think I would have disliked that movie at that length because it has so many, so little locations. But there you go. Anyway, back to Gilgamesh. Again, it seems like TV material, that this is a TV movie, and possibly it is, but in all fairness, again, it's sufficient cinematography, sufficient costumes, and there it kind of stops. You know, it has hammy to even bad acting, which seems like a TV standard too, that can be fun at the best of times. I mean, I think we mentioned maybe off air that this reminded me kind of Cena and Hercules standards, which is not a slam, but they appeared to me when I saw them like it isn't super high budget. They aren't investing in you know big Shakespearean actors who will win the show awards. You know, it was kind of hammy, but maybe in that case a good way. In Galgameth, it falls pretty flat and pretty fast too. But I don't know, were you ever a fan of Hercules and Cena in the 90s? And is that a fair comparison, you think?
I think it's a fair comparison. The one thing I would say was, you know, I grew up, again, in Northern Ireland. There's never anything on the TV, so you watched anything. So I watched Hercules, Cena, the whole shoot, and I was not addicted, but I would almost set my days around them. And I didn't have a problem with it. Yes, it was hammy. It was decently acted. And it was engaging enough. This is the children's version that... And I can't believe any child or, you know, young adolescent would actually want to sit and watch this.
Be bored out of their minds pretty quickly.
Yeah, totally.
And then when you have a very bad and not engaging lead character... which possibly is, again, I don't truly care, but the main credit, the first actor mentioned on Wikipedia, so we can maybe assume that this is who the prince is, Devon Neil Oatway. And that's not a name that rings in the bells, and probably not a very frequent actor. Certainly not a good teenage actor. No charisma, and he's needed to carry the movie, obviously, and he's needed to carry the kingdom as a character. And it's and yeah, he has some, you know, demons to face. You know, he doesn't like horses, for instance. So you know that's gonna come back, and he's gonna be great at the end. You know, so what in this case? You know, I like templates. They're a role. You can do great stuff with old templates. Expect the templates. That can be a delight. Here it's, you know, you don't care about anything, and even I think I'm fairly good at sensing, okay, this is well done on a for the teenage / kids audience, but I have a good radar for that, I think, even though a movie might not be for me if talking in a general sense. But I'm pretty certain that you know, as you said, that it wasn't an appealing product as such. And why it's getting repeat viewings on TV, or at least did, because it was there, I suppose.
Yeah, that's the only reason that I can see.
But okay, let's move on to Galgameth himself. And some of the minor positives here, you know, combining some talk about the special effects and Galgameth / Pulgasari, if you will, in this movie. Could you extract any good things in terms of his presence and the special effects needed to get him on screen? You know, what's your thought on that?
Very much from my point of view, as with Pulgasari, the early scenes look the best. Mm-hmm. When Galgameth or Pulgasari were tiny little cute, you know, monsters. When Galgameth grows up, if you like, it's better than Pulgasari, obviously. There's no, you know, back screen stuff, but It's nothing major. It's nothing to write home about, and it is quite noticeable that when he gets to his full size, that they do cut between here's, you know, models or people in suits filmed on their own, and oh, here are the actors. It's not necessarily a bad thing, particularly, but there's nothing out of the ordinary here.
Yeah, I agree. The initial stuff is better. You know, there's a good shots of him. The suit actor running around big sets, and therefore that illusion looks very real because he's small at the beginning, as you said, yeah. And so and he looks, you know, kind of freaky but still fairly cute, you know, as he grows up, and there is certain energy in his scenes, a certain tiny bit of fun, but little else when you concern yourself with the main story, with the kingdom in peril and the Lord Black of this movie, you know, trying to take over the kingdom and all of that. And And seeing Galgameth drunk, cute little scenarios, I guess, needed for a children's film. I know that sounds bad, but that's what they did. To convey a light mood, I get that, but it's all on conception stage. It's not something that ignites, at all here. The only bit I liked, actually, that made me laugh is when he stands in front of arrows being shot at the prince, and the arrows bounce off him, and someone says that, he's the result of black magic. It's black magic. Run. That was not verbatim, but I remember some delivery in that scene from the person who was trying to shoot him with arrows was, kind of there.
Yeah,
That got me again. Like 5 seconds out of the total 5 minutes, perhaps that works. That was 5 seconds that worked. So, how are you otherwise in terms of that that I was talking about, that you can gauge what's well made for children and teenagers, despite you not being target audience? Can you put yourself in the mindset of this is good for them, but not for me? You know what I mean?
Pretty much. I mean, I am incredibly immature, and I'll be able to handle anything, and you can sort of gauge what'll work. I've got relatives that are sort of that age market, and I sort of know what lights their fire and what doesn't. This just wouldn't. The whole it's back to the whole America, and this is a real generalization, but it's back to the whole America treats all its audience like morons. Pulgasari, even young Gary, okay, they were unintentionally funny from our point of view. This goes out of its way to do the whole pratfall things. The bad guys are just, they're so dumb. You could, oh dear. And coming out, he throws a spear down or a whatever. They come out of a doorway and all fall over it. And it's this whole, oh look, let's make it a bit Keystone Cops because kids will like that. Well, kids kind of won't, because kids have as much intelligence as you. And it's that whole, oh, this will be funny, let's stick this in, and it's just not. It's intentionally trying to make you laugh with stuff that isn't funny.
And I think also Galgameth turns a bit too scary for kids at the end, because he grows from cute little pudgy baby, I guess, and into full-on, kaiju monster that fights on the side of good, obviously, but it looks a bit too menacing, I think, for young kids anyway. So then that means the site isn't very tuned by the filmmakers as such. I mean, it's not like it turns into a horror movie, of course, but he goes from cute to menacing, and that's the only mix here that is kind of cool. That again, talking seconds, when he is bigger and the effect shots are made in the way that they do channel, the traditional kaiju imagery, suit actor on miniature sets or what have you. That the mix is not bad for a few shots here and there, but it's still glimpses all throughout the movie, and less so as the movie goes on. Very much less so. I have only one other note, so I'm gonna quote my favorite moment, and then you can rant away as much as you like, if you like.
Lovely.
When Galgameth catches the cannonball with his mouth, that was well done. That was rather cool,
Yeah.
I mean, the special effects technicians, I guess we should praise the most in this movie, and
Pretty
the suit
much, yeah.
actors, because it wasn't a lame American attempt at echoing the masters of Japan, Eiji Tsumaraya and his team, the classic team who brought you Godzilla. It's still pretty solid, technically, but not a reason to sit through it. Fast forward through it if you want to see some cool effects shots. That's my recommendation, in all honesty. And do that, but do not write the review after that, because if you're going to write the review, then you have to sit through it all. We got to be
Yeah,
fair here. So
exactly.
if you're going to be a
Yeah.
critic, then you have to endure it. And we did.
We did.
So go on, Paul. What is there more to say? Floor is yours.
Really, I the whole way through it, regardless of the fact that it's aimed at kids, obviously, that it's not well done, the biggest problem I have is this whole stripping everything away that give the original film any sort of gravitas, whether it works or not. Pulgasari, yeah, okay, it was North Korean, directed by a South Korean director, you know, et cetera, et cetera. We did all that. And a lot of the things in it are related to their background, their history, their culture, and this isn't. But it's such a generic story that they could have got away with a lot more than the medieval thing. It makes it overly light, even for kids. And stripping everything away just means everything that could have made it worth watching isn't there. I could go on for hours, but I won't.
Maybe we should get you a show on the network where we just press record, leave, and then you're...
Yeah, you might lose followers if you do that.
Right. Well, it was, on paper, and certainly to get a show out there in the bonus episode format, connecting stuff to the main show, because these are loose remakes. That's fun enough to do, and it's kind of easy enough to do, and although there's part love, part hate in this show towards the remakes, I mean, I don't mind doing it because it is doable. No one else is really doing it, and screw you guys, it kind of amuses me, and maybe that is the way it should start. It amuses me, produce a show that is possibly listenable for everyone else as well, and maybe you can get some people on board with the amusement of connecting Galgameth and Pulgasari, but maybe not get people on board to watch the movie. And I don't have a problem with that, in all honesty. Yeah. Not in this case.
Totally. I mean, I, at the end of the day, I am glad I sat through it just to be able to say, I sat through it, I saw it, and oh dear. I like ranting, so it sort of worked for me, and I hope anybody that listens to it will at least maybe try and sit through 5 minutes just to really get where we're coming from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Okay, we are done for this bonus episode. Thank you again for listening and following us from the main episode that is... on the web, on iTunes and Stitcher and what have you, available all over the place. But thank you for those of you who sticked with the website and followed us in the bonus episode and in this website exclusive podcast. And thank you, Paul, for sticking with me. And I'm going to let you free now after movie kidnapping you.
Great. I'm going to go back and rewatch. Oh, no, actually, I'm not. cool. I enjoyed it. Fun as always, Ken.
You know what? And a recommendation to you, actually, because the next bonus episode, because this Korean week is only 2 episodes old, and it's actually going to be 3 episodes in total. The next bonus episode involves, really an even worse, in a way, movie, but way more fun movie, which is a South Korean-US co-production called Ape. And that I recommend for you to watch, Paul, and if you feel you have any interest after watching it, then there is a pretty... meaty bonus episode waiting where I'm guested by Ron Strong, who knows a lot about the movie and the era and about 3D, because this was a 3D movie. So that's a recommendation to you. That's what we're doing in the next bonus episode. So thank you for following Korean Kaiju Week. In the first and second episode coming up in 2 days after you hear this is the third and final episode on Ape, and maybe that's all Korean Kaiju there is to cover, or in need. Maybe there's not a need to cover any more after this, but we'll see. Maybe I'll do a D-War episode sometime. but anyway, this concludes episode 2, so thank you again, Paul, for sticking around. Really appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me, Ken.
Excellent. Bye-bye, everybody.